So are there questions on what we did last week or before?
Well, I have a question. Mm-hmm. I don't know it's how much related, but do we implement other qubits in laboratory or something like that? Like qubits or things like that? Do we have them?
Let me think. So there's no inherent reason that you can't. I mean, certainly the atoms that people use are not actually two-state things. They have many possible states. So the nuclear spins, in NMR, the nuclear spins frequently are spin 1/2. So there they really are qubits. Photons, if you're using polarization, that's naturally a qubit. But if you use, say, position of the photon, whether it's in mode 1, mode 2, or mode 3, that's, you know, could easily, well, that implications. Whether it's actually been done or not, I don't know. Not offhand, anyway. I would guess there's probably a few experiments out there that have. But most of the time, they just use qubits because that's where most of the work is done. And implementing a universal set of gates is usually simpler. Now, there's something called, let me think, there's something called hyperentanglement, where they create photons that are entangled in multiple degrees of freedom. So they might have like the polarization and frequency entangled, something like that. So there are, and actually, yeah, so just more generally, there's definitely stuff, particularly with photons, that uses continuous variables. So that's kind of an extreme variant of qubits, where you have infinite dimensional Hilbert space. But like I said, most of the time, qubits is kind of simplest to deal with. So people mostly stick to that. Other questions? Yeah?
So to implement an oracle, it needs to be a fully quantum oracle, or can you?
Well, so to use it in an algorithm like Grover's algorithm or the George Joseph algorithm, it has to maintain coherence. That's the important thing. So that when you put a superposition of inputs, you get an entangled state and not just a random mixture. So people have discussed, for instance, using Grover's algorithm for searching a real database where, you know, you want to, you have a long, long, long list of things, and you want to find something, and for some reason it's unsorted. So to do that, it kind of you need some sort of superposition access to the database where you can query things in superposition, which of course a real database wouldn't normally give you. But you can imagine implementations that would. So is that the kind of thing you were asking about?
Yeah, like because I don't. It's hard to imagine that they'd ever be able to fit an entire database into quantum bits.
Right. Well, certainly with the current experimental state of quantum computing, that's hard to believe. But well, okay. So we don't really know what's going to happen with quantum computing in the future. It's certainly possible that memories can get a lot better. But actually, for Grover's algorithm, so first of all, Grover's algorithm, let me point out that there's also, you can use it to speed up, the Oracle doesn't have to be a literal database, right? So I did mention this last week, but it can be just some function, like, you know, evaluating a satisfiability formula. And that is just implemented with a quantum circuit, and there's no problem. I mean, assuming you can build the quantum computer in the first place. But even if for a real database, it's kind of the memory itself could be classical so long as it can interact with a qubit, which is the superposition over queries. So there may be some sort of hybrid solution. That I mean, because the oracle itself is not in superposition. I mean, I mentioned that for this quantum adversary method, but the oracle itself has a definite value. So it's only the queries that have to be in superposition. So there's a little bit of room there. But the other thing to bear in mind is that, you know, well, classical computers and classical memories, they increase exponentially over time. And if we can manage the same thing with quantum computers and quantum memories, then what seems totally implausible today could very well be completely commonplace in the future. I mean, when I was a kid, personal computers were just kind of coming out. And at some point, we got a Commodore 64, which had 64K of memory. And I said, 64K of memory? Why would you ever need that much memory? Okay. But today, of course, that's, you know, if you had a phone with only 64K of memory, it would be totally inadequate. So, you know, these things can change over time. That doesn't mean it will with quantum computers, but there's at least that possibility. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so what I want to talk about today, well, actually, what I want to talk about this week is kind of another class of quantum protocols that could be generally broadly classed maybe as information theory. So we're going to talk about quantum error correction later in the week. So that's an essential tool for building a quantum computer, but also for communicating in the presence of errors. We'll talk about quantum cryptography. And then today and tomorrow, we'll talk about some more general properties of quantum information. So, so what I want to start with is distance between quantum states. So what does it mean to say that two quantum states are close to each other? Okay? Well, if they're pure states, we can use the inner product. Right? So if two pure states have inner product 1, then they're identical. If they have inner product 0, they're orthogonal. So that's kind of the farthest away they can be. And if the inner product is somewhere between 0 and 1, then they, I mean, if they're very close to 1, then they're very close. If it's very far from 1, if it's close to 0, then they're far apart. But this is not quite right, because, of course, inner product could be between two states could be negative or imaginary. And, well, it's maybe not immediately obvious how to interpret that. So what we actually want is something called the fidelity, which is, for pure states, is the absolute value of the inner product. Okay, and of course, absolute value seems right, because if two states have inner product minus 1, then that means that they're actually the same except for a global phase of minus 1. And fidelity gets rid of that global phase and tells us really that they're the same state. Okay, so this is good. This is good for two pure states. And actually, this fidelity has a nice operational interpretation. Which is kind of the probability of having one state able to impersonate the other. This is not a technical term. It just seems appropriate. So what do I mean by this? Well, suppose you make the measurement that projects on the state psi, or the orthogonal state, the orthogonal subspace. But you actually have psi. Sorry, I actually have phi. So what happens is the probability of getting the outcome psi psi is what? Well, it's fidelity squared. Okay? So fidelity has an interpretation as the square root of a probability, the probability of having one state look like it's actually the other state when you make a measurement. Okay. And so this operational meaning gives us a way to generalize at least a little bit. So so this particular operational meaning will still work just as well if instead of phi, we have a mixed state. Okay. So we'll replace phi by some mixed state sigma. And then we can talk about the fidelity, I guess, in this case, between psi and sigma. And to make the interpretation match, let's make it the square of the fidelity. And so we want to figure out what is the probability of getting the outcome psi when we make this measurement. Well, that's straightforward, right? You know that. That's just trace of psi with sigma. Okay? So that tells us how to define the fidelity between a pure state and a mixed state. But it's not obvious from here what to do when both states are mixed. Right? This operational meaning doesn't work anymore because, you know, if you replace psi by mixed state, there's not necessarily any sensible measurement that projects on the mixed state rho and on the orthogonal state. Right? Rho could have support over the whole Hilbert space. It could have support only on part, but it could be very uneven on those parts. So it's not immediately clear what to do. And when I write down the formula, it still won't be immediately clear that has anything to do. But it turns out this formula works. So the fidelity between two mixed states is trace. So here's the square root that was up there. And square root of rho to the 1/2 sigma rho to the 1/2. OK, so this is, again, kind of crazy. So you can kind of see how it's related to this, right? I mean, there's the trace, there's the square root, and these two rho to the 1/2 together make kind of one rho that would appear here. But because of all the square roots and non-commutativity of density matrices, you can't just say, oh, this is trace square root of rho times sigma. So this formula is, when you look at it, is kind of opaque, but it does. If you stare hard enough, you can see how it generalizes this one. Nevertheless, it turns out this is the right generalization. So why is that? So by the way, you guys know how to take square roots of density matrices? It's not immediately obvious. So first of all, in principle, it's possible to have, you know, multiple matrices that will square to the same density matrix, right? Of course, that's true of regular numbers too, but then you take the positive one. So it's the same thing here. So the easiest way to do it is these are all Hermitian positive semi-definite things. So their eigenvalues are non-negative, and in fact, you can diagonalize them. So what you do is you take the square root of something, you diagonalize it. And then you take the square roots of the eigenvalues. Okay. And so it'll be diagonal in the same basis as the original matrix was diagonal. But of course, here, because we have this square root inside and the square root of the whole thing, you have to go in two steps. You have to do that. You have to diagonalize rho, and then you have to diagonalize this thing. Okay. Anyway. So that makes it a little tedious to calculate such things. But nevertheless. So why is this the right definition? So we have something called Ullmann's theorem. And Ullmann's theorem says that this definition that I wrote down is actually totally compatible with the original definition of fidelity based on pure states. And in particular, the fidelity for mixed states is equal to the maximum over psi and phi of absolute value psi phi, where psi and phi are purifications of rho and sigma. So in particular, if rho sigma are on some Hilbert space Q, then we purify them, purify with a Hilbert space R, and so psi then is the purification of rho. So the trace over R of psi is equal to rho, and sigma is purified by phi. Okay. And then we have to take the max because remember purification is not unique. And so Ullmann's theorem says that if you take the best possible purifications, which means basically you can let one of them be arbitrary and pick the other one to be the closest thing. So if you pick the best possible purification so that the purifications are as close together as possible, the amount that you can get them close together is equal to the fidelity between rho and sigma. Okay? So this by itself would be a sensible definition, and Ullmann's theorem tells you that it's equal to this crazy formula that I wrote before. Okay? And then fidelity has a bunch of nice properties. Well, besides Ullmann's theorem. So, let's see. So we have, I didn't get this number, but first of all, I'll note that fidelity is between 0 and 1. And in particular, the fidelity of two states is 1 if and only if the states are the same. Okay? So you can immediately see that for pure states. Maybe from Ullmann's theorem, you can see how that applies for mixed states, too. And on the other hand, the fidelity of two states is 0 if and only if they have orthogonal support. So what that means is that rho has some subspace where it has so rho is a mixture of some of states, right? You can think of rho as a mixture, and those states will all lie on some subspace of the Hilbert space. If you look at the span of those states, and that doesn't depend on what decomposition of rho you pick. Okay, and you can do the same thing for sigma, and you'll see that the two Hilbert spaces that they have support on, in this case, where the fidelity is 0, are orthogonal. Okay. So this is kind of a generalization of the notion that two pure states that are orthogonal are orthogonal. I mean, that have fidelity 0 are orthogonal. Okay. Let's see, what else? So if you just look at the formula up above, it's not at all obvious, but it is the case that f of rho sigma is equal to f of sigma rho. Although you can see it from Ullmann's theorem. And now let's see, what else? So the other nice thing about fidelity is that it doesn't really depend on your choice of basis. And it isn't changed by unitaries. So in particular, that means that f of u rho u dagger and u sigma u dagger is equal to f of rho sigma when u is unitary. Okay, so density matrix under unitary changes this way. Rho goes to U, rho, U dagger. So if you take the whole Hilbert space, you apply unitary, well, you can see that the inner product is not going to change, right? Because then you'll get a U dagger U. And fidelity doesn't change either. Yeah?
So in the Bloch sphere, do pure states have any, I mean, can they have fidelity equals zero?
Yeah, so fidelity equals zero means that they're orthogonal. So in the Bloch sphere, that means they're opposite.
Right, but if it's not...
Oh, if it's not pure.
Well,
for qubit, so looking at this thing, rho and sigma have to have orthogonal support.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they're pure, then they can have a one-dimensional support.
That's right.
But on a qubit, if you don't have one-dimensional support, then you're not pure. So if you have a two-dimensional support, which is the only other option for a qubit, then you have support on the whole Hilbert space. So there's just not enough space for that to happen for mixed states. But once you go up to Q-trits or, you know, four-dimensional Hilbert spaces or so on, then it can happen. Okay? And one more property I want to mention, which is, so I said that unitaries can't change the fidelity between two states, but completely positive maps can. So for instance, you could have the completely positive map that will throw away the input and replace it with the zero state. Okay. And then no matter what the fidelity between the initial states was, the fidelity between the final states, well, they're both zero, so it's one. So that means that the fidelity can change. But fidelity is a measure of distinguishability between states. Right? It says there's this impersonation interpretation, which says that it's the ability of one state to be mistaken for the other. And so in particular, if the states are orthogonal, then that means that one state will never be mistaken for the other. And in general, if it's low, it's hard to mistake one state for the other. So you can easily distinguish the states. Now, if you think about it, that tells you that under a completely positive map, it couldn't be possible to make the states more distinguishable, right? Because if so, you could do some measurement that would better distinguish states by simply doing the CP map first and then measuring, right? And we know that there's some fundamental limit to how distinguishable states can be sometimes in quantum mechanics, right? Very, very close states, you shouldn't be able to distinguish them very well. And so what that tells you is that fidelity has to increase, or at least not decrease under CP maps. So that says that f of E of rho E sigma is greater than or equal to f of rho sigma for any CPTP map E. Okay? So are there questions on fidelity? Yeah.
About the Bloch sphere, is there some nice geometric interpretation of the fidelity between two not necessarily pure states inside the Bloch sphere?
Yeah, I'm not sure there is. Do you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I feel like in Nielsen and Crying there's some picture of the Bloch sphere in the section about fidelity. So it's possible, but I don't think it's very. I don't think it's really a nice interpretation. Mm-hmm.
I think in Nielsen's song it says, this is
this
nice geometrical interpretation for the trace systems. There isn't one.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, okay. Okay. So are there other questions on fidelity? Okay. So in that case, let's move on to the trace systems. Apparently it does have a nice geometrical interpretation. Okay. So fidelity is one notion of distance, but it's not the only. I mean, it's not really a notion of distance, right? Because close means fidelity one, and far means fidelity zero. But there is another notion of distance that's also very useful, which is called the trace distance. So trace distance, the definition looks a bit less crazy, and it's probably better just to write it down for mixed states right off. So the trace distance between rho and sigma is equal to 1/2 the trace of the absolute value rho minus sigma. Okay. So again, absolute value you can find by diagonalizing the in this case, it's not a density matrix. So if absolute value of a density matrix wouldn't do anything because it's already a positive matrix. But rho minus sigma, that can have negative eigenvalues. But it's still diagonalizable. So if you diagonalize it and take the absolute value of the eigenvalues, that gives you something, and then you take the trace of that. You take the half, and that's the trace distance. Okay? So when you do diagonalize rho minus sigma, then you get some positive eigenvalues. Well, I don't need to write that. So you get some positive eigenvalues and some negative eigenvalues. And then the trace distance is the sum of the positive eigenvalues plus the sum of the absolute value of the negative eigenvalues. Right? And so what this is telling you is that there are places where there's, so if you imagine just thinking of the diagonal basis, then you say, well, there's some states for which rho has a much bigger component than sigma. And so the trace distance is bigger when for each of those terms. And there's some where sigma has a much more dominant term than rho. And so we'll add that just the same way. Okay? So for instance, it's immediately obvious for trace distance, as it wasn't for fidelity, that this is symmetric between rho and sigma. And that will be a property I'll write down in a bit. Okay, so the other thing to mention about the trace distance, it's a quantum generalization of a classical distance measure called statistical distance. Which is a distance between two probability distributions. Okay. If you think of the case where rho minus sigma is diagonal, actually the classical case, rho and sigma are both diagonal in the same basis, even the standard basis. Okay, and so in that case, certainly rho minus sigma is diagonal. And so then the terms along the diagonal, the eigenvalues, are the difference between the probability of getting an outcome with probability distribution, well, rho in this case, and with probability distribution sigma. Okay, and this is then just the case, just the generalization of that, to the case where rho and sigma might not commute. Okay? And trace distance also has an operational interpretation. Which is this. So trace distance kind of captures your best probability of distinguishing between the two states with a measurement, which is subtly different from the interpretation of fidelity, which was the probability of making a measurement to project on one and getting confused with the other. So we can say that the trace distance is equal to the maximum over P of M's of D of trace rho EM and trace of sigma EM. And so this is the classical statistical distance that I mentioned. So this theorem tells you another way in which the trace distance is a quantum generalization of statistical distance. It says that if you make the best possible measurement to distinguish between rho and sigma, then you'll get a probability distribution over outcomes. So you'll say you get outcome m with probability trace rho em or trace sigma em. And so that'll give you two classical probability distributions. And statistical distance between those distributions is the same as the trace distance between the original density matrices. Okay? And actually the optimal POVM is kind of a sensible one. And what you do is you just project on the subspace spanned, well, on two subspaces. The subspace is spanned by the positive eigenvalues of rho minus sigma and on the negative eigenvalues of rho minus sigma. So the subspace spanned by positive eigenvalues, that's a subspace where rho is more likely. And the subspace spanned by negative eigenvalues is a subspace where sigma is more likely. Right? Because sigma is more likely to be on this space and rho is more likely to be on that space. Okay, so this is the best measurement you can make to distinguish between rho and sigma. And that gives you this classical probability distribution. Okay? And so consequently, there's another interpretation, which is a related one, which is to say, suppose you're given one of rho and sigma. And you have 50% probability of having each. And your goal is to guess which you have. And you're just given one copy. But you can guess correctly and so your probability of guessing, so if rho and sigma are identical, if they're actually the same, then of course you have no way of knowing, so the probability should be a half of guessing correctly. But if they're not the same, then the trace distance tells you how good a guess you can make. And so in particular, your probability of guess being correct will be a half plus the trace distance. Sorry, half times 1 plus the trace distance. OK? So basically what you do is you do this measurement. You say, well, if it's on the plus eigenspace, I will guess rho, because rho is more likely. If it's on the minus eigenspace, I'll guess sigma, because sigma is more likely. And that gives you this probability. Trace distance has a bunch of properties like fidelity did. So the range of trace distance is also between 0 and 1. So the 0 is obvious because there's an absolute value in the formula. The 1 is maybe a little bit less obvious, but the extreme case, I guess I didn't write this down as a property this time, but when rho and sigma have orthogonal supports, then this will give you there's the subspace where rho has support, and that will give you 1. The subspace where sigma has support, that will give you another 1. And then you add those and take a half. OK. So what properties of trace distance do I want you to know? Well, first of all, so fidelity when the two states were the same, then the fidelity was zero. The fidelity was one. In trace distance, when they're the same, the trace distance is zero, right? Because rho minus sigma is zero. So that's the first property, that the trace distance is zero if and only if rho equals sigma. Second one is that it's symmetric, again, pretty obvious in this case. Or I should say, I mentioned that before. Okay, the third one is a bit less obvious, and you'll actually prove this in the tutorial, which is the triangle inequality. So if you have the distance between trace distance between two density matrices, and you inject a third one, then the total distance increases. So you know, you have here rho, you have sigma, and what this is telling you is that trace distance is actually a metric in the which is kind of the mathematical notion of distance. So if you try to add up this distance and this distance, it will always be greater than this distance, right? And this is telling you the same kind of geometry holds for trace distance. Okay. Let's see, what else? Well, the trace distance is also unitarily invariant. And again, it's supposed to be a measure of distinguishability. So it should again be true that states can't become more distinguishable under completely positive maps. Now, in the case of trace distance, that means not that it increases, it means that it decreases, right? Because lower trace distance corresponds to more similar states. Questions about trace distance. Yeah?
Does it have any fundamental relation to the other one, which was the fidelity?
Right. So what is the relationship between trace distance and fidelity? They're different measures of distinguishability, but they both have kind of the same asymptotic behavior. They should, right? So we say that if two states are very close, they should have fidelity that's close to 1, and trace distance should be close to 0. And similarly, if they're very far apart, then they should be far apart for both measures. And actually, you can set bounds on that. And bounds say that 1 minus the fidelity, sometimes called the infidelity, is less than or equal to the trace distance, which is less than or equal to the square root of 1 minus the fidelity squared. Okay, and in particular, this tells you that if fidelity is close to 1, then trace distance is close to 0, and vice versa. Okay, but when fidelity and trace distance are both kind of far from 1, there's no really simple relationship between them, because these are just upper and lower bounds. Yeah?
Does this infidelity have that mathematical distance notion?
It does, actually. Yeah. Yeah?
Would you want to explain what we mean by classical statistical distance?
Yeah, so it's just, I mean, so the formula, so if the probability distribution is our pi and qi, so this means that you have the first one, you have probability p I of outcome I. The second one, you have probability q I of outcome I. So the formula for this is just basically the same. It's a half the sum of the absolute sum over I of the absolute value of p I minus q I. Okay, and I mean, kind of the motivation for this is, well, if you have to guess which probability distribution you have, you can guess with this probability. So it's really just the same thing. It's just only for the boring classical case, which somehow has a few practical applications. Any other questions? Okay. So in that case, let me move on to a different topic. So I told you how we quantify the distance between two states when they're close or far. So what's another quantity that we've talked about a lot in the class that would be useful to quantify? Entanglement. So unfortunately, quantifying entanglement is not as straightforward as quantifying distance between states. I mean, even for distance, it's not trivial because we have multiple different sensible measures of distance. So entanglement is much worse than that because we have multiple different sensible measures of entanglement. And what's more, a lot of them are very hard to compute. And in the case of distance, it's kind of clear usually which one you should use. And when the states are close to the same, it doesn't really matter that much. In talking about entanglement, it's much worse. But there is a special case that we can kind of sensibly talk about. And so first of all, we can talk about bipartite entanglement. So that's the simplest case. So we have two people, Alice and Bob, and they share some state. And we want to know if it's entangled and how much it's entangled. In particular, the case of pure state bipartite entanglement is simple is maybe an overstatement, but it's at least something we understand, and there's good notions of it. So let's talk about the pure state case of bipartite entanglement. Even then, there's, like I said, a kind of a long story you could go into. But so in this case, we have some pure state, psi AB. So what that means is that Alice has the mixed state rho A, which will be the trace over B of psi. And Bob, of course, has the other side, has rho B, equals trace over A of psi. Okay, and if you think about this, well, what does it mean for psi to be entangled? Or what does it mean for psi not to be entangled? So when psi is not entangled, psi should be a tensor product between A and B. And when that's the case, and you take the trace over one of A and B, what's left over will be a pure state. Okay, so if rho A and rho B are pure states, that tells us the state is not entangled. Conversely, if you think about a maximally entangled state, suppose psi AB equals some, well, even let's just think of A and B having a single qubit each. So say psi AB is 0, 0 plus 1, 1. And then when you trace over one of them, you get a state that's a density matrix. And in particular, it's a density matrix a half, a half. Right? So it's just proportional to the identity, maximally mixed. So that gives you some idea that maybe the way to quantify the amount of entanglement is to say how mixed rho A is. And one good way to quantify the notion of how mixed rho A is with the entropy. So Neumann entropy of rho A is frequently written with an S. and it's equal to minus trace row log row. And because we're in the area of quantum information theory, we like to do all our logs with base 2 to be compatible with qubits. And this, of course, is really just the same formula. It is, in fact, the same entropy that you'll see in thermodynamics. Or I guess to see the formula, you have to be going to statistical mechanics. But nevertheless, it's the same thing. But we're not interested in the kind of thermodynamic aspects of it right now, although there's an interesting story to be told there. I'm just interested in the information theoretic aspects. And it turns out that there's a classical version of this, the Shannon entropy, which is the diagonal special case of this, which is very important in the classical theory of information. And maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow. But for now, we'll just use this as a notion of mixedness. So I should say again some word on how to calculate this. So log of a density matrix can be defined just in terms of a power series, the same power series as log of a normal number. And another way to think about this is by diagonalizing rho. Log rho will be diagonal of the same basis as rho. Of course, you know, log is singular when rho has zero eigenvalues. But luckily, rho log rho is not, because 0 log 0, well, if you take x log x, as x goes to 0, the limit is 0, right? Because x goes to 0 faster than log goes to infinity. So you can just ignore the 0 eigenvalues and then take the trace over the non-zero eigenvalues. Okay. And so let's see. So entropy has a bunch of properties that make it a nice thing to work with. So first of all, if the dimension of the Hilbert space is d, then the entropy is bounded by log d. And this happens when the density matrix rho is proportional to the identity. So it's a maximally mixed state. Okay? So that's the maximum value of the entropy. The minimum value of the entropy is 0. So that minus sign makes the entropy non-negative, because remember, the eigenvalues of rho are going to be between 0 and 1, so log rho will be negative, have only negative eigenvalues. And so the minus sign cancels that out. So S of rho is equal to 0 only when rho is pure. Okay. Next, we have this. So by this, I mean rho A and rho B, but it's simpler to write it this way. So S of a bipartite system AB is greater than or equal to the difference in the entropies on each side. Sorry, the absolute value of the distance, the difference. So it works either way. And then you have another quantity, which is called subadditivity, which is another thing about bipartite systems, which says that the entropy of a bipartite system is not only greater than the difference between them, but it's less than or equal to the sum. So why is that? Well, so if you have a mixed state, which is a tensor product, not necessarily a pure state, but a mixed state, which is a tensor product between a density matrix here and a density matrix here, So maybe I can write that. Equality when rho AB is equal to rho A tensor rho B. So in this case, well, what you can do is you can just take the two sides are just totally independent. So it makes sense that the entropy should be the sum of those things. But when there's correlations between A and B, even just classical correlations, not necessarily quantum correlations, then you're losing some entropy. So entropy is kind of a measure of the amount of randomness in the state. And there's less randomness in these two taken together than there are adding them up separately, because some of the randomness is redundant between part A and part B. So that's the kind of the conceptual logic behind subadditivity. Then it turns out, so in kind of for classical entropies, this is kind of the end of the road. But for quantum entropies, there's another property called strong subadditivity. Which is actually considerably much more difficult than these other properties to prove. And strong subadditivity is actually a property for three systems. So I don't think I'm going to use it in this class, but I figure I should write it because it's an important property of the entropies. So it says that if you have a tripartite system, ABC, and you add that to the entropy of one of the parts, that's less than or equal to S of AB plus S of BC. And of course, B is kind of arbitrary, but B appears twice on both sides, basically. But you could have done it with any of the three systems. Okay. So one additional thing I want to point out, which is that if you combine these two properties, that tells you that if you have a global pure state, which was the case I started motivating this by, well, that means that the overall entropy is 0 by B. And then applying C, that tells us that this is greater than or equal to the absolute value of S of A minus S of B, which in turn implies that S of A is equal to S of B. Okay, so if you have a global pure state, then the entropy on Alice's side is equal to the entropy on Bob's side. And so what that means is that if we're interested in quantifying entanglement for a bipartite pure state, we can take one of the density matrices on one of the sides and just take its entropy. Okay, and it doesn't matter which side we do because they'll be the same. So that's one reason why entropy is a good notion of entanglement. Okay, are there questions on these properties of entropy? Yeah.
What is the condition to have equality in the last one?
In strong subadditivity? That's known. I couldn't tell you offhand. It's a little bit complicated, okay. I think. Other questions?
How is it defined, the three?
Which?
The interview with three.
So this is just another way of writing S of rho when rho is a tripartite system that has an A part, a B part, and a C part. And then, you know, S of B is what happens when you trace over A and C for that overall thing, et cetera. Other questions? Okay, so like I said, we can use the entanglement. Sorry, we can use the entropy as a measure of entanglement. by picking just one of the sides and taking the entropy. So why is that a sensible thing to do? Well, one thing I told you was well-defined, because it doesn't matter which side we take. But there's more to it than that. There are things we should insist on from a measure of entanglement that are true in the case of entropy. So entropy is what's known as an entanglement monotone. So what does that mean? Well, first of all, it means that I already told you that if we have an unentangled state, it's a global pure state, so it's a tensor product state, and that means that the state on either side is pure. And so then the entropy of pure state is zero, so that means that the entropy is zero for unentangled states. And it's non-zero for entangled states, strictly greater than zero for entangled states. Okay. Another thing is that suppose we have a global pure state, and Alice does some unitary rotation on her side. Or Bob does some unitary rotation on his side, or both. Okay, so entanglement in that case shouldn't really change, right? It should be something that doesn't depend on, you know, any local change of basis that Alice might want to make. It's a property that's kind of shared between them. And entropy does have that property, so it's. And by this, I mean local unitaries. So in particular, the entropy of Alice's density matrix is equal to the entropy when you do some unitary. I guess I didn't write that as a property of the entropy, but it's true. OK? And the third thing is kind of the most important thing, which is that not only should it not depend on local unitaries on either side, shouldn't depend on local unitaries on Alice's side or Bob's side, but it shouldn't depend on a broader class of operations known as LOCC. But it can depend on that, because LOCC is going to involve some classical stuff as well, it can involve measurements. So in particular, we should say it doesn't increase. So it's not increasing on average under LOCC. Okay, what is LOCC? So remember, we're in the bipartite case. So we have Alice and Bob. And Alice and Bob might be sharing this entangled state. And certainly Alice can do local operations on her side. Bob can do local operations on his side. And we think these things shouldn't change the entanglement. Now, before, I was just thinking about local unitaries for property 2. But this is stronger. Now I'm going to also allow measurements in CP maps. Okay, and then furthermore, Alice and Bob can communicate classically. So this is what's going to distinguish a measure of entanglement from a measure of classical correlations. Because you can create classical correlations by classically communicating back and forth. Whereas quantum correlations, entanglement, somehow you shouldn't be able to do that. And an entanglement monotone is something that has this property that it's a measure you can apply to a state. And local operations and classical communication, that's what LOCC stands for, L, the O, and the two C's. Cannot increase the measure. Okay? So in particular, if you start out with an unentangled state that has a zero value for this entanglement monotone, well, then it has to stay zero under local operations and classical communication. On the other hand, if you start out with an entangled state, well, it can't become more entangled under this measure by applying local operations and classical communication. Okay? And entropy, in fact, has this property. So that's why we like it as a measure of entanglement for pure states. Now, for mixed states, why don't I put this off until tomorrow? But for mixed states, you can also define measures of entanglement. Unfortunately, whereas entropy turns out to be kind of the most sensible one for global pure states, for global mixed states, even bipartite mixed states, there's a lot of choices, and none of them is clearly better than the other. So you're left to deal with a mess of different possibilities. Okay, so are there questions on this? Yeah.
Can you give an example how classical communication can influence the quantum state?
Oh, absolutely. So here's a kind of trivial example. Suppose you start out with a tensor product state, and then just do totally classical stuff. So Alice will flip a coin. That's a possible CP map. You generate a random bit, 0 and 1. And then she'll send the value of that coin to Bob. Now they have a correlated state. It's either, you know, it's a half 0, so it's at 0, 0, and it's a half 1, 1. Okay, so it's not a tensor product state anymore. But it's kind of silly. It's a classical state, but you can still write it as a quantum state. Okay, and then there's lots more interesting things you can do. Like you can have some complicated shared entangled state. Alice makes a measurement on one side. She tells Bob what the outcome is. He makes a measurement that depends on what Alice said and sends the result of that back to Alice and so on back and forth as many times as they like. So LOCC is actually a very complicated class operation. Yeah?
What do you mean by non-increasing on average? What's
that? Well, because we're making measurements and can have random values. So it's possible to have situations where you can make a measurement where if you get one outcome, the entanglement will actually increase. But if you get the other outcome, the entanglement will decrease. And so what this says is that on average, it will always decrease. And I think there was another question.
Your example was purely classical, the one about classical communication. But I don't really see how this could in any way.
But you're allowed to measure things. So these local operations involve measurements, and the class of communication can convey the results of measurement outcomes between Alice and Bob. Okay, so there's scope for a lot of really non-trivial stuff. Yeah, we won't really have time in this class to get into the wide range of weird stuff that can happen, but. But maybe you'll see a little bit. Okay, that's it for today. So tutorial is at 2, you said. Yeah. Okay. All right.